I'd like to introduce our next speaker, John Watkinson, a well-known author, wrote The Art of Digital Audio, The Art of Digital Video, is a highly respected consultant. John does not have a presentation, but I know that he has some very thought-provoking comments to make to the audience. So, John, it's over to you. Thank you.
Ah, 1-0. Yes, it works. I'll just make myself at home here. Got a little clock here. People think it's so I know what the time is, but the ticking keeps me awake. I haven't met some of you here for a while, and those of you that know me from the past always remember me as being rather cynical. I'm afraid I've got worse. So the thing that strikes me about cloud technology is that we've been here before. There is no actually new technology at all in the cloud. It's all bits and pieces. Oh, I'm exceeding unity loop gain here. Better stand somewhere else. There's nothing new in the cloud. It's all technology that we've come across before. Joined together in ways that we've come across before, doing things that we've done before. So I have some difficulty in understanding how the cloud differs from what we've done in the past. I have quite a background in computing, which of course is now called information technology, which in itself is an oxymoron because most of what's transmitted isn't information. It's data, which is generally not always useful, sometimes is damaging, and sometimes is pure propaganda. The information content, of course, is very, very slight, which is why compression technology is possible. And the enormous leaps that compression technology has made simply proves the point that there's less and less information out there. So if the technology hasn't changed and we're still pushing electrons around in silicon, which is, I believe, still what happens with cloud, and we're still reversing magnetic fields on little revolving disks or some similar types of storage mechanisms, then the laws of physics haven't changed and the concerns that we should have about this technology won't have changed either. So what are those concerns? Firstly, in television, whatever that now is, we work in real time. Television pictures are data. Audio is data. But the way that television and audio differ from generic data is that audio and video have an implied time base, and watching and listening on any other type of time base, either at a different speed or with interruptions, is not rewarding. Basically, we don't do egg timers, and any technology that attempts to provide solutions to broadcasters that results in an egg timer will go down like the Hindenburg. I was concerned that the previous speaker admitted not to knowing much about television. He ought to rectify that. It's been my experience, having had feet in computing and in television, that there's a great deal of mutual ignorance and mistrust. I do remember when computers used to fill an entire room. I remember mainframes. I remember walking in there carrying a bunch of 80-column punch cards with Fortran. Those were the days. And of course, the great thing about walking to the mathematics building and giving your stack of punch cards to a nice lady in reception was that nobody could hack it. because there wasn't a way in. Of course, mainframe computers didn't give way to personal computers. They went via mini computers. One of the nice things I remember about mini computers was the fact that you couldn't hack them because they had proper operating systems in which every input was treated with suspicion. And anything that attempted to make the operating system put its head in a bucket of water caused it to trap. And it would then say, I've been asked to do something stupid, so I'm not doing that, you're out. But of course Windows, which is almost an operating system, neglected any of that. In fact, Windows actually satisfies many of the definitions of a virus. Because it fills up your hard drive and slows down your computer. And of course, virtualizing is one of the least efficient ways of using processing power known to man, because you spend more time virtualizing than you do doing anything. I remember as a computing student, this was before IT was invented, our professor in the mathematics department at Southampton used to have a definition of a mouse, and he said it's an elephant running an IBM operating system. And of course Windows has taken over that mantle. Windows is a dinosaur running an IBM operating system. It's unfortunate, because the previous speaker showed a very interesting graph and very correctly referred to Moore's law, which is the colossal increase in computing power over time, which we've seen and which is absolutely correct. What he didn't refer to was the colossal decrease in the efficiency of software, which took place in parallel to that. Basically, we don't have software anymore, we have bloatware, in which the amount of processing power needed to perform a given function increases exponentially every few days. So in fact, we've all got colossal amounts of computing power. Even our telephones outperform our personal computers of a few years ago in terms of the number of binary numbers they can bash in a millisecond. In terms of what they can do, they're pathetic. So the problem we have is not that we need more processing power. We have got processing power coming out of our ears, and it is practically free. Being able to make transistors whose dimensions are consistent with the wavelength of light means that computing power is essentially free. The problem we have is software. Because without software, your computer is basically a paperweight. And the problem we have is that today, the majority of software we have is, being kind, suboptimal. Being realistic, it's complete shit. I cannot go anywhere, either in my daily life or as a consultant, without finding software faults. I know people who can't get out of their Jaguar because of a software fault in the anti-lock braking. It thinks the wheels are still revolving, so it's not safe to open the doors. So you park the car and it won't let you out. And the other problem you have with computing elsewhere, well, actually there are two problems. One is processing power and one is bandwidth. Some processes are compute intensive, like weather forecasting. You put in a little bit of data, but you have to think about it very, very hard. And other processes are bandwidth intensive, where you don't spend a lot of time making it, but delivering it is a big deal. High definition television, for example. The thought of building a cloud working on HD again gives me the shudders, because what poor machine can stand having 100 streams of 3 gigabits per second arriving? That's not an IT nightmare, that's an IT impossibility. You can't do it. So at one end of the scale, we can't deal with high bitrate systems such as large television pictures. And at the other end of the scale, there isn't a requirement for very, very dumb devices, because everyone can afford devices that aren't dumb. And given the requirement for security, how do you know that a cloud is secure? You have to take somebody's word for it. And yet, we have seen so many times in IT-related systems, there have been colossal failures where somebody's word should not have been taken. But then it's too late. You find out the hard way. Now, that the problem we've got at the moment with IT is that we have adopted widely substandard software which has appalling data integrity and security, and we're suffering for it. People are making a nice living out of breaching security. Basically, it's theft. And until we have systems which can prevent that, then sending anything anywhere is a risk. I can think of a number of clients who would have the absolute shudders if I suggested to them keeping their data anywhere other than where it is. Anybody who's doing anything remotely involved with security, with banking, with personal information, you have to know where your data is. You have to know who's got access to it. And most of all, you have to know who doesn't. And in cloud computing, I don't say don't use it. What I do say is, before you use it, get answers to those questions. Where is my data? You know, there are laws about where you can keep certain types of data. If you have a database of personal information, you have to know where it is. Can you keep something like that in a cloud? Your information might be in China, it might be in India, it might be in California, it might be on the moon. Because you don't need to know, it could be absolutely anywhere. Another problem with computing, particularly where you're sharing resources, and this problem is as old as the hills, is how do you handle the peaks? Again, we are becoming bored with systems that fail just when you need them. Because systems are designed for average use. The 13 amp ring main wiring of a British house is designed for average use. If you connect a 3 kilowatt fan heater to every 13 amp socket in your house, your fuse panel will climb off the wall. It's not designed for that. It's designed for the statistically probable loads that the average person in the average house will apply. It's not designed for everything to work full blast all the time. And that's the kind of computing solutions we're currently building. Most of the time they're all right. But if lots of people try to use them simultaneously, they fall over. For example, when that airliner splattered at Heathrow recently, when it just made it with both engines out, the website for professional pilots fell over. Because everybody who's interested in aviation in the whole country started to try and find out what the hell happened. And that website just went splat at the very time when people most needed the information from it. Interestingly enough, although they deny it, PayPal came very close to falling over a couple of days ago. For reasons which I don't need to go into, because you all know what they are. So the problem we have with any distributed cloud-like system, whether it's computing or something else, whether it's motorways or airports, is that they fail to handle peaks, and that the more the bean counters get involved and the cheaper they try to make it, the less able things are to handle peaks. Now, the one thing you need as a broadcaster is utter reliability. Blank screens, bad news. Can you guarantee that if you are a client of a cloud-based system, can you guarantee that your bit that you're trying to do in this nebulous structure will carry on working, even though somebody flies an airliner into a tower block, or something crashes, or war breaks out? Will my thing still keep working, or will the panic caused by an external phenomenon result in patterns of behavior in large numbers of people that have a knock-on effect of making what I'm trying to do die? Now, wouldn't it be ironic if, as a broadcaster, you're trying to cover a disaster, but the general public, over whom you have no control, is using up so many resources trying to establish what's happened that your coverage of the disaster can't take place, because all the processing power is gone. This is what's known as the tragedy of the commons. No individual sheep grazed too much. There's no individual farmer was to blame. But the system fell over because it couldn't handle the peak. The other problem that I see with clouds is finding out who's responsible. It's hard enough today finding out who screwed up in complex IT systems. Imagine how much harder it is when you don't even know where it took place. You don't know who to complain to. You don't know whose desk to stand on, or you don't know who to sue for compensation when it all falls down. So I would say that by all means go ahead and use cloud, but do so in the knowledge that there are a number of issues that you need to be certain of in your own mind and comfortable with before you do it. And the other thing is, it's like entering into a contract. Don't enter into any contract without knowing how to get out. Assume it's going to fail and try to visualize what damage it will do to you if it fails. And if that's not acceptable, don't do it. In other words, don't just drive. Put your seatbelt on. So those are my main concerns. Another concern that affects the use by broadcasters is that many of our destinations for imaging will not be television sets in the future. In fact, I don't even know what a television set is, because once a display starts to use pixels rather than trying to steer an unwilling electron beam around the place, then the screen is displaying data, and therefore it becomes a computing device. And so the dividing line between computing and broadcasting tends to disappear. You can't even use broadcasting anymore, because a lot of broadcasters don't do it. If broadcasting is radiating stuff when you feel like it to an audience who have to receive it when you decide, unidirectionally, then a lot of broadcasters don't broadcast. Because now you can log into a broadcaster's website and you can watch or listen to what they would have broadcast, or what they used to have broadcast, or what came out last week. That's not broadcasting, because you're the only person who might be watching that. The broadness kind of goes away. We don't know whether broadcasting will survive. But if what we now call broadcasters survivors entities, what they won't be doing in the future is simply radiating stuff at a time they've chosen at random and hoping somebody's out there with an antenna. I mean, if your TV set is plugged into a power socket, why the hell are we wasting RF bandwidth on something that's not mobile? We should be using RF bandwidth for things that are mobile. Perhaps the future of television lies in handheld devices that are truly mobile. But if your display is only that big, do we need to send HD to a display that big? I think not. So possibly the future revolves around multi-resolution production, where we can send colossal pictures to digital cinemas, slightly less immense pictures to people's homes on large green sets, and very small pictures to personal television receivers, for want of a better word. And to do that, we require formats that allow us to work in multi-resolution. So if it hasn't died already, that will be the last nail in the coffin of Interlace, because Interlace is a scanning technology that's fundamentally inconsistent with multi-resolution. So I'm just about through, and I'm also running out of time here. So I'll just leave you with the remark about the young lady who went to see her doctor. I said, "Doctor, I've been married for six months and I'm still a virgin." And the doctor says, "Oh, what does your husband do?" "Oh, he's a programmer." "No, I don't mean what does he do for a living. What does he do in the bedroom?" "Well, he just sits on the end of the bed and tells me how good it'll be when it works." Thank you.